Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by City Pulse, whose Top of the Town contest continues until Tuesday. Ballots are available online at LansingCityPulse.com.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. I always feel better on the first day of spring knowing the minute spring is scheduled to arrive. And the rumor in the Current State studio here today is that it's already arrived, but I don't know for sure. And I'm a geek like that. If I know the minute that spring arrives, you know what? I feel better after that minute than I did before that minute. Because this voice in the back of my head says, hey, it's spring. Winter is officially over. Now, it doesn't look that way outside necessarily, but I just feel better on the inside about that whole scenario. Anyway, it is the spring equinox. We're glad you've decided to join Current State here this morning. We have got an interesting show here today. Yesterday, right at this time on the program, East Lansing State Representative Sam Singh said that he was taken by surprise by a proposal that came from Republicans on the House Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Singh serves on the subcommittee and had found out just shortly before he joined us on the program that the panel had proposed a plan that would cut state revenue to universities that approve new long-term contracts with faculty unions. Now, several schools, including the University of Michigan and Wayne State University, have been pursuing the new contracts to delay the impact of Michigan's new right-to-work law, set to take effect 1 week from today. Now, Representative Singh says the provision is especially unfair in Wayne State's case. He says that's because their new contract, the new proposed contract with faculty, cut $10 million from the school's budget. The GOP-backed provision would nonetheless take away $27 million of state revenue from the school because of the new 8-year contract. It calls for the cuts if new contracts don't show more than 10% in savings. At Wayne State, they do not. Here is how Representative Sam Singh described the proposal yesterday.
Wayne State got a number of great concessions according to management. They got $10 million of health care savings. They got lower costs of raises over the years. They also got teacher tenure. So if a faculty member wasn't doing a good job, it's easier for them to remove them. Again, these are reforms that have been asked for by the Republican Party for years. They're being instituted, but now they're going to be penalized because it might extend a contract a little bit longer for some of those unions.
Now, to try to figure out what is going on, I spoke later in the day yesterday to Republican State Rep Al Pasholka. He's the chairman of the House Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. I first asked him about the aim of this provision and why he supports it.
Well, the purpose of this provision is, number one, I think we all want to have more money go to higher education. And we also want to be able to hold down tuition. And what we're saying here is we don't think it's financially responsible or fiscally responsible to enter into these long-term contracts, especially when you've got no way to project costs going forward. So this is a way of incentivizing some good financial practices. And the other piece that folks are not talking about is we'd like to see tuition restrained to 3% or less. We've gotten to a point in this state, and if you look at the 15 universities, in the last 10 years, the tuition increases have ranged between 90% and 160%. And we hear in our offices every day from students and from parents and from taxpayers that we've got to be able to control some cost and make college affordable for Michigan kids.
And how does the measure define long-term contract?
Something that's outside the norm. Normally, these contracts are 3 to 4 years. They're not 8-year contracts. They're not 5 or 10-year contracts. What we're really trying to get to is we don't want to take money from anybody. We're trying to increase funding for higher ed, and in fact, the budget that came out today increases funding by $31.3 million.
Well, this comes on the heels of a recently proposed 8-year contract at Wayne State that cuts university costs $10 million, but the new provision would mean that Wayne now stands to lose $27 million in state funding right on the heels of negotiating down their budget. How do you respond to people who allege the school is being punished, really, for doing something right?
The premise of your question is absolutely wrong. And in the hearing, we asked Wayne State point blank, what are the savings to taxpayers? They made some statement about possibly $10 million in health care costs, but you've got an 8-year contract with a $1,000 signing bonus and a 20% pay increase. There is $0 saved for taxpayers. So with all due respect, the premise of your question is absolutely wrong. And on any of these contracts that have been talked about, there are no taxpayer dollars being saved at all. If taxpayer dollars are being saved, nobody in the legislature is going to have a problem with it.
Well, it sounds like there's some serious misinformation here, or a misunderstanding between the university and the committee here. The university issued a statement that calls it punishment.
Well, we've met with the university privately. We've met with the university publicly. And we've flat out asked, and I've asked, and other members of the committee have asked, how much in taxpayer savings are you getting with this contract? And the answer from President Gilmore a week ago was, I don't know. There was no number given. So if the university is saying that there's millions of dollars being saved, I'd be more than happy to sit down with them and go over those numbers with them.
East Lansing State Rep Sam Singh sits with you on the House Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. He told me Tuesday morning that he could and should have learned about this provision days before, like late last week. What do you think of that?
Well, I know Rep Singh has done a couple of press conferences and done some press releases, but we've had conversations about performance funding, so I think he did have some indication that there would be something coming, and that's my only response to that.
But nothing in this much detail. That was his point to me Tuesday morning, was that the 15% cuts were news to him until 8 o'clock Tuesday morning.
Well, I disagree. I mean, we've had discussions and talks about this and what the performance funding and the metrics would look like.
Tell us about Tuesday's response to the measure. What are people saying to you? How are they responding?
I've heard response from a lot of the parents that have called my office and have thanked us for taking a stand to try to hold down costs so that we can eventually make tuition more affordable for folks. And really, that is the driver of this whole initiative, is to make college affordable and to protect the interest of taxpayers, of students, and of parents.
Is it now in front of the full House, then?
The subcommittee bill does go to the Appropriations Committee first, so it would go to House Appropriations, then to the House floor. And, of course, the Senate is also working on their own version.
Any comment from the governor's office about this? Do you know how he feels about it?
I have not spoke specifically with the governor about this.
Don't know. That's Republican State Rep. Al Pasholka. For its part, Wayne State University issued a release which calls the legislation punishment for a proposed contract within the legal requirements of Michigan's right-to-work law. It goes on, and I'll quote, "We are stunned and saddened that the legislature would take such measures in reaction to a contract that is both good for the university and perfectly legal. This is a case of legislators questioning the judgment of people who understand and are responsible for the best interests of the university. While some legislators may feel satisfied, a cut of this magnitude will harm not only the university, but the people and community it serves, and most importantly, our students. There is no magic to university budgeting. When appropriations decrease this severely, a university cannot cut its way to a balanced budget. We will have no choice but to raise tuition, unquote. And the Michigan Public Radio Network's Jake Neer also worked on this story and is working on this story. He joins us now. How are you, Jake?
I'm great. How about you, Mark?
I'm fine. Thanks for joining us. You also spoke with Sam Seng and Al Pasholka, as we did here on Current State. But you also heard from House GOP spokesman Ari Adler. What did he have to say?
Well, Mr. Adler made it pretty clear that when it comes to the House Republican majority, it's pretty clear that there's a lot of support for this among that caucus. And, you know, we're talking about a budget subcommittee here. So this bill that passed this, proposal, so this has a long path through the legislature into the governor's desk at this point. But when it comes to its path through the House, it seems to me like, again, the Republican majority has a lot of support for it, and Ari Adler said that the House Speaker wouldn't necessarily say that he supports the specific 15% cuts here, the specific provisions, but he would say that he definitely supports the theory or the concept of, as he puts it, keeping universities and schools accountable for their negotiations in these contracts. I did hear a quote from the Gongwer News Service from we're also talking about school districts as well that could see cuts if they, extend these union contracts.
Right.
And Representative Bill Rogers, who is the chair of another subcommittee on the school aid budget, said that when asked why he was including this provision in the school aid bill, he said it came from leadership. So if you had to ask me, in my opinion, it seems like it has a pretty clear path through the House.
You also got with Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville. How did he respond?
Well, talking to Senator Richardville was kind of interesting because he had said, again, he also supports this concept of keeping, as he says, universities accountable on these contracts. But at the same time, when he was asked about the specifics of this proposal, he was a little bit less enthusiastic, I guess. And here's what he had to say to reporters and me yesterday.
I don't think that a punishment kind of thing is the right way, but we do need to talk to the universities about how they're going to spend this money and if they're going to sign these contracts.
So if you heard that just alone, you might think, well, you know, this is going to have a tough time in the Senate with the Senate Majority Leader not necessarily being on board. But he did go a little bit after that to give himself a little wriggle room, basically saying that when he was posed the question, when it comes to almost $30 million in cuts for Wayne State and over $40 million for the University of Michigan, so you wouldn't support those kinds of cuts, and he said, well, not all of it. So he was very kind of, he has a lot of time, let's just say, to have his opinion on this evolve, let's just say. And there's a lot of, we'll see what happens.
Very good. And we also understood, as of late yesterday, the Wayne State Board was scheduled to vote today on their new contract. The Michigan Public Radio Network's Jake Neer. Thanks, Jake.
Thanks, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. You can reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. The United States is the premier nuclear power in the world, but the geopolitical landscape has radically transformed since the height of the Cold War. Meanwhile, our stockpile of ballistic missiles, nuclear submarines, and large bombers is aging and in need of expensive upgrades and replacements. So, as America moves forward in the 21st century, what kind of nuclear arsenal makes sense? Here to help us answer that is Steve Pfeiffer. Steve is the former ambassador to Ukraine and director of the Brookings Arms Control Initiative at the Washington, D.C. think tank. Welcome, Ambassador Pfeiffer.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Appreciate it. Before we get into the details, can you give us a sense of the scale we're talking about here? I'm sure the exact number is a guarded secret, but about how many nuclear warheads does the U.S. maintain?
Well, actually, it's not a secret. In 2010, the United States released a number and said that as of September 2009, the total American stockpile was 5,113 weapons.
Okay.
Which is a huge decrease from the Cold War. At the height of the Cold War, there were 25 or 30,000 weapons. But you still have to ask the question, does that number make sense 20 years after the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union?
What about the dollar cost of maintaining that arsenal?
The dollar cost in terms of maintaining them on a day-to-day status is estimated at, say, $30 to $40 billion a year. So it's a part of the defense budget.
Wow.
But where the costs get really big is if you look, say, 5 or 7 years down the road, where the Navy's going to have to start building a new ballistic missile submarine to replace the Ohio-class submarines, which have to be retired in about 15 years. And then you're talking about an estimate of $6 to $7 billion per boat, not counting the missiles or the torpedoes.
So upgrades are hugely expensive.
Well, or replacements. I mean, a submarine can basically operate for about 35 years, but then it just gets to the point where you've got to retire it. So you have to build a new submarine.
Okay.
And they're trying to find a way to cut that cost, but shipbuilding prices usually go up.
Are we still producing more nuclear weapons, or has production of new nuclear weapons stopped?
Well, when you talk about the nuclear weapons per se, actually, we don't produce new nuclear weapons now. What the policy is, we extend the life of existing weapons. So they'll do what's called a life extension program, where they'll take an existing weapon and they'll go and replace those parts that have basically reached their shelf life, but basically keep the same weapon intact. And one of the things that we've learned in the last 10 years is that nuclear weapons in the American stockpile actually have much longer longevity than had been anticipated, say, 25 years ago.
Okay. But again, we're getting back to the number. We're talking a little north of 5,000.
That's probably come down to maybe in the last 4 or 5 years. The guess is it's probably come down to more like around 4,600, 4,700.
Okay. Okay.
So it's moving down.
The other key player here is Russia. It's Russia and the United States. Even after a new START treaty is implemented, Russia will still have at least 2,000 nuclear weapons, from what I'm told, and plus an untold number of non-strategic weapons, likely numbering in the thousands as well. What is Russia's place in this discussion?
Yeah, the guess is that Russia has about 5,000 to 1,000 total nuclear weapons, so roughly the same as the United States. And this is one of the issues about the new START treaty, which President Obama and then President Medvedev signed in 2010, is that treaty, which is a good step, it limits each side to about 1,550 deployed strategic warheads, but it only covers those strategic warheads that are deployed. It doesn't address reserve weapons or tactical weapons. So it covers only about 30% of the U.S. arsenal, and maybe it's time for the United States and Russia to begin talking about limits on all of their weapons.
And I misspoke a minute ago. I guess the new START treaty has been implemented already. Okay. All right. Just last Friday, the United States decided to restructure its European missile defense approach. How does this alter the situation involving Russia?
Well, it remains to be seen, but for the last couple of years, Russians have been not enthusiastic about reductions going beyond those that they've already agreed to in the new START treaty, which is now being implemented. I think the Obama administration would like to reduce further. One of the reasons the Russians have said they did not want to reduce is because of concern about the American missile defense plans for Europe. And phase four, the last phase, which is the one of most concern to Russia, was canceled last week by the Defense Department. So hopefully that removes an obstacle that then might allow a resolution of differences on missile defense, which then could remove an obstacle to further negotiations. Now, the initial word out of Moscow is not encouraging. But the Russians often react very slowly to ideas. As one of my colleagues once said, the Russians say no, no, no until they say yes. So hopefully we haven't heard the final word.
How have our allies in Eastern Europe responded to what we've just announced or what you just referred to?
I think the first three phases were primarily aimed at defending Europe. So in phase two, there would be missile interceptors in Romania. In phase three, there would be interceptors in Poland. Now, those will go ahead, and those interceptors will have the ability to protect Europe. Phase 4 was going to be, though, a much more capable interceptor that could intercept intercontinental ballistic missiles coming from Iran to the United States. So, and basically, I think what the Defense Department has concluded, there's probably a more efficient way to defend against the United, to protect the United States. So this plan doesn't affect the ability of missile interceptors to defend Europe. What we've done is we've canceled Phase 4 as we looked for a more efficient way to defend the United States.
But does the cancellation of Phase 4, does that amount to some kind of olive branch to the Russians or anyone else?
Well, it's interesting. When you talk to people in the government, they say the cancellation was driven by technical questions about Phase 4 and budget questions. They say Russia was not a consideration. But it has to have occurred to somebody in the government on the U.S. side that if we cancel this, which the Russians have been complaining about for 3 years, that has to have some kind of a positive impact on Moscow.
You referred to Iran just a second ago. We've got to talk about Iran. We've got to talk about North Korea. Sure. What about the threats that they pose, and how does that figure into this?
Yeah. Well, a part of the decision that was announced on Friday would be to deploy additional interceptors in Alaska, which will give the United States some measure of protection against North Korea. Now, one of the things the Defense Department said they're going to do is they're going to test and prove the technology before they actually deploy new interceptors, which is a good step. Because I think some of the interceptors that were deployed in Alaska were actually put into the field before they'd been fully tested. So there's some questions, how capable are these things? But that gives us some measure of protection against North Korea. Now, remember, North Korea, they've had one successful satellite launch. They're still probably a number of years from having a missile that could reliably reach the United States. And I think Iran is further behind. So the missile defense conversation in the United States has been...
Is further behind?
Yeah. It'll take Iran longer to get a missile that could reach the United States than it will take North Korea. So.
Okay. But that's geography, right?
It's geography, right? Yeah. Iran now can fly missiles maybe to 2,000 kilometers, but they need to get 5,000 miles to get to the United States. And that's just a longer way down the road. And the debate about missile defense, or what the U.S. government is trying to do, is basically stay ahead of that, is have missile defenses deployed before North Korea and Iran would get missiles that could reach the United States. And so far, I think that's a race that the U.S. probably can do fairly well in, if they get the missile defenses to work.
If reducing the overall nuclear threat is priority number one, if we assume that is the goal, what needs to happen here in the short-term future?
Well, I think the biggest thing that the United States could do is working with Russia is to reduce our stockpiles. Because while the United States and Russia each have about 5,000 nuclear weapons, the nearest third power is France with only 300. And it's very hard, I think, for the United States and Russia to go to third countries and say, don't build up. Or go to a country like Iran and say, don't acquire nuclear weapons when we have such a large inventory ourselves. Now, if we are reducing our arsenals, I think that probably is not going to affect directly a change of mind in North Korea or Iran. But what it does do is it gives us greater credibility with other countries to apply pressure on North Korea and Iran. So I don't think it's a coincidence that in the last 3 years, when we've had the New START Treaty, the United States has had more success in persuading other countries to crank up economic and financial sanctions on Iran.
What's the acceptable level? I mean, you threw out this 4,700 number most recently here. What number makes most sense in your view?
Well, I think the next step in a U.S.-Russia negotiation only would be to try to get all nuclear weapons and try to come down to about 2,000, maybe total weapons. I think it would be hard to get the Russians to go much below that without bringing in third countries, which I would say for the next step, because once you bring in third countries, your negotiation becomes much more complex.
Okay.
Ultimately, I'm a member of Global Zero. I think if we could reach a world where we could be confident that there were no nuclear weapons, which would require huge verification measures beyond what we have now, an enforcement mechanism, I think from an American perspective, that world has some attraction. We have friendly neighbors in Canada and New Mexico. The protection afforded by the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans and very powerful conventional forces. So, and that would avoid the risks that I think are growing of use of nuclear weapons as more countries acquire them. But that's a long way down the road, and a lot has to happen to get there.
Steve Pfeiffer is former ambassador to Ukraine and the director of the Brookings Arms Control Initiative at the Washington, D.C. think tank. It's been very special to have you in the studio here today. Thanks for joining us to discuss nuclear weapons in the 21st century.
Thanks for the opportunity.
On the way on Current State, we take a look at our long-term spring weather forecast. Stay where you are. Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's time for Current State's weekly Neighbors in Action segment. Every Wednesday, we feature a person or organization that is working to make our community a better place. This is a listener-generated segment, meaning that each week, the person or organization we feature will be nominated by you. And this week, we're going to learn more about Habitat for Humanity here in Lansing. We welcome Denise Paquette, the director, or executive director of Habitat for Humanity. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Mark.
And Monica List is an East Lansing resident who is planning to move into a Habitat for Humanity home before the end of the year. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. I think a lot of people are aware of the basic mission of Habitat for Humanity, but Denise Paquette, why not put it in your own words for
us? Sure. Our goal is to eliminate substandard housing in the Lansing area and actually also worldwide. In Lansing, we've built over 100 homes in our 26 years, and this year we will be building 4 new houses and rehabbing 2 houses. And then in addition to that, we also do a ramp program for folks who need to be able to get in and out of their houses because of reduced mobility. And we're also kicking off a new program this year, which is to do critical home repairs for low-income homeowners. So not Habitat homeowners, but the person down the street or the elderly person down the street whose roof is collapsing and they're on a limited income. We're putting together a program that will help repair those projects.
So you've been expanding your mission in recent years.
Yes, we are expanding our mission from strictly new homes to new homes, rehabs, ramps, and now the repair corps.
All those ramps are the result of our graying population. Is that it? That's demographics,
that's
right?
That's demographics. And, you know, we'll do probably our 600th ramp will be this year.
So 600th?
600th. In 16 years, we've done almost 600 ramps.
Oh, you've been at this longer than I thought.
Yeah.
Okay.
That part of it.
Okay. Tell us about the people you serve. What are their needs? What are their circumstances?
The people we serve are low-income folks who have sustainable income because they're going to pay a no-interest mortgage back to us. And they often are living in poor housing. I've been in houses where I've seen snow coming through the walls. We've been in houses where you can't stand in front of the sink to do the dishes because the floor is so rotted. Also, families who live in very overcrowded situations or are perhaps living in their mother-in-law's moldy basement because that's what they have access to.
Okay.
We also have had families where they live in different apartments or different cities because they can't afford to live together or they're too large.
Oh. You know? Hmm.
You know, we had a family of a mother and her children, and the older boy lived with a couple of siblings, and the mother lived with the daughters in two apartments in the same complex. And we were able to pull together a house for them so that they were able to live together.
Oh, cool. Monica, tell us about yourself. How did you connect with Lansing Habitat then?
Well, I learned about the organization from a friend of mine who was in a similar situation. So she is actually now a Habitat homeowner. At the time, she was still working on her sweat equity, doing her hours to be able to qualify for homeownership. And she, you know, I was very desperate looking for an affordable housing option. And she said, you know, I'm doing this with Habitat for Humanity. They basically sell you a house at 0% interest. And why don't you get in touch with them? And I did. And it's been a wonderful opportunity for many reasons.
Do you know where your house is or the property location or anything like that at this point?
Yes. It is in East Lansing on Biber Street. That's off of Lake Lansing Road.
How exciting. So you drive by it?
We drive by it
day
often.
And night. Day
yes.
and night and look at your new the space that will contain your new home.
We've actually visited the property. We've been inside the house. It's a rehab, so it's somewhat functional at this point. And we will start working on rehabbing it sometime in April.
Yep.
Tell us more about your situation. You've got a family then, or?
I have a family. Our income is limited because my husband and I are both students, and we have 3 children. So we have a 17-year-old, daughter and two sons, 8 and 4. And we were all living in a very small two-bedroom apartment, and we were unable to find any other affordable options that we could sustainably pay for.
Okay.
So this has been a really great opportunity for us.
Tell us about any new initiatives here. What's on the short-term future for Lansing Habitat for Humanity? Well, I know you have 4 new houses this year.
4 new houses,
right?
This year.
That's most immediate.
That's most immediate. We're going to be completing a rehab in the next month and a half. Then Monica's rehab will be before the end of the year. And then on April 24th, we're kicking off the repair program. And some folks from General Motors Foundation are going to come over, and we're working on the east side of Lansing. So Allen Neighborhood Center and us are partnering to work on the east side of Lansing to find the low-income homeowners who need the repairs that they can't do themselves or can't afford to do and pay a contractor.
How do people qualify for that repair program?
They will still have to be low-income. They will have to be the homeowners. It will not be in foreclosure. There won't be notices of foreclosure. You know, some of the basic things you might think of.
Mm-hmm.
And so they need to send us an application. And they can find information at our website at habitatlansing.org. And then the way it'll work is we will have volunteers go out and do the work.
Do you enjoy a pretty healthy level of volunteer involvement? I know volunteers drive a lot of what's going on.
Volunteers drive most of what we do.
I've known that since Jimmy Carter got so involved in Habitat
yes,
for Humanity.
Exactly.
That was a very memorable thing. How do people go about connecting with you?
They can, again, go to our website to connect with us, to volunteer or to donate or whatever.
What is that website?
It's www.habitatlansing.org.
Habitatlansing.org.
Yes.
Okay.
And we will be doing some orientations for future volunteers starting in April. With 4 houses needing to be done this year that are brand new, we're going to need a lot of volunteers. And we're putting together that schedule so that we can make it easy for people to volunteer.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Denise Paquette, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity Lansing, and Monica List is an East Lansing resident who's planning to move into a Habitat for Humanity home this year. All of our recipients of our Neighbors in Action segment, here those people featured, are nominated by you, our listeners. And Denise and Habitat for Humanity and Monica were nominated by Cindy Milock and Robert Phillips. We thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, if you would like to nominate a nominee for our Neighbors in Action segment, just get to us at currentstate@wkar.org. Michigan State University's Broad Art Museum is opening a new exhibit on Friday. It's called Pattern, Follow the Rules. And for curator of contemporary art, Allison Gass, it's her first big exhibition since arriving at the Broad. She told WKAR Scott Pohl that Pattern, Follow the Rules was inspired by the Zaha Hadid design of the Broad Museum building.
People constantly talk about the facade of the Broad Art Museum as being a feat of digital engineering. And it really is this extraordinary pattern that's created through an architectural engineered method. These pleats of steel that form this repetitive pattern over the front of the building, or every side of the building, really. And because of the reflective surface, they also really change. The visual experience of being here changes as the seasons change, as the time of day changes. So I was really interested in this idea of optical effects created through rigid engineered pattern. And this was something that I was seeing all over the contemporary art world recently, this idea that artists are really returning to pattern. Pattern has been kind of thought of as just decorative, as not something that is in the realm of fine art. But artists are really using it, and they're using it in a new way. So this exhibition, Pattern, Follow the Rules, redefines a notion of pattern, not so much as a decorative form, but as more like a computer pattern or a mathematical pattern. It looks at artists who are making systems for themselves, setting up rules or structures that they follow, and the result is these richly patterned forms, paintings, fabric tapestries, sculptures. You're going to see all of that, and each of them has some exciting optical effect to it. And very much, again, like the building, there's an optical effect when you see it. All the work in the show has an interesting optical effect to it.
You've shown me a few of the pieces, and it reminds me of what was a thing for a while. Fractals were very popular for a while, maybe not as art or contemporary art as much as on album graphics and that sort of thing. Exactly. Is there something to that notion?
Yeah, fractals are really an iterative form. So this idea of something that regenerates, or forms that repeat and repeat and repeat. And so that is very similar to this. Every work in the show has a repetitive process to it. Some of the works have repetitive forms. Some of them just have a repetitive process that's evident. But it really is this idea of a very thoughtful, very long-term process that goes into each of the works in very different ways. So, for example, you'll see this beautiful string drawing by an artist named Allison Schatz, she generates a visual representation of a mathematical sign system, pounds little nails into the wall, and then strings white thread across them to create this incredible effect that almost looks like a line drawing in space, and the shadow and the string collapse, and you can't quite fix your eye on it in different ways. So that'll be a 60-foot long installation that she does here. We have a great tapestry by the artist Pei White, which is images of reflective things and objects from her studio that she photographs and scans into a computer, are then woven into a giant 80-foot tapestry that from a distance looks like you're looking at a reflective image. When you get up close, it's totally fooled your eye, and it's just matte fabric that's tightly woven to create all of this. And then there are some really wonderful paintings by the great painter Rudolf Stengel, who kind of, to me, pioneered this idea of working with pattern. He makes representational paintings that look almost like wallpaper, but they're very rich and lush. And then a series of younger artists who I think are inspired by that, who are creating a kind of new abstraction.
Were these existing pieces that you found to fit the theme of this exhibition? Were some of them commissioned for this exhibition?
It's a great question. It's a really big combination of both. So a lot of this is work that I've been seeing recently. Some of these artists are artists that I have worked with before, who are some of my real favorites and have come into their own, I think, in a lot of ways. The two major commissions are the Allison Schatz string drawing that I mentioned, and a wonderful piece by the artist Teresita Fernandez, who's an extraordinary artist, recently was awarded the MacArthur Genius Grant. She's on President Obama's NEA Advisory Committee. She will install an enormous piece in our big atrium gallery that will kind of float almost like a cloud. It's called The Night Sky, and it's the plastic covering of fluorescent light bulbs, believe it or not, in different colors that she adheres with a chemical so they appear to kind of float together and then suspends in different layers in space. So as the sunlight comes into that gallery, the tubes are kind of pink and purple and gray, and the light, the ambient light around there really almost feels like a sunset or a sunrise taking over. So that piece will be really wonderful. So those are the two big commissions. A couple of other pieces have been made specifically for the show. Pei White is doing also a hanging mirror mobile, which is really very beautiful, that she had to remake specifically to fit our ceiling and our slanted ceiling height. And two of the painters in the show have made paintings specifically for the work. So I feel it's a great combination of it's all work made since 2007, but then some pieces made specifically. And I also want to mention that there are two wonderful paintings from the Broad Art Foundation on loan, a painting by Christopher Wool and a painting by Mark Grogan, which we're shipping here from LA, and we're delighted to welcome those here as well.
One thing that strikes me about an exhibition like this is the notion that some people enter a museum of contemporary art and they don't quite get it. They don't understand why this is art. This is maybe entree to that. You can see the beauty in some of these pieces, and it maybe will help you understand other works here at the museum to get a sense for where this fits within the rest of the exhibitions that they see here.
I'm really happy that you said that, because that's very much how I conceived of this show. When, you know, I came to take this job at the Broad at MSU, and I know that a lot of the immediate audience hasn't spent maybe as much time in contemporary art museums as I have, which is a lot of time. And to me, this exhibition is very much one that I hope will seduce kind of and excite people and make them feel contemporary art, abstract art, conceptual art, because all the works in the show are abstract and they're all based on an idea, so they're conceptual, but they are also all very beautiful. And sometimes beauty becomes a word that curators don't like to use, but I'm not ashamed of it in this instance. And I think the show is designed very much to be beautiful. And I hope that it will help people come in and find some real pleasure in looking and then be comfortable saying, wow, there's a really interesting conceptual idea behind this project. And maybe once you translate that into other works in the museum that are purely conceptual and have less of a visual quality, it becomes easier to understand. So it's not an accident that this is my first big show and that it's about beauty and visual pleasure in a lot of ways.
How long will it be here?
It will be on view until June 23rd, and after that it will travel to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver and potentially on to one other venue. So we're sending the Broad show out on the road.
All right, Allison Gass, Curator of Contemporary Art at the Broad Art Museum at Michigan State University. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
If you're feeling unusually centered today, unusually balanced, you can thank the cosmos. It's the spring equinox, the beginning of spring when we see the sun for 12 hours and we see darkness for 12. Well, what is the weather likely to be this spring? WKAR's Peter Whorf spoke with meteorologist Andy Provenzano yesterday about the first days of spring 2013, and they took a look ahead at the weeks to come. Their conversation actually began by looking back 1 year to an unusual and problematic March.
You know, everybody's probably remembering last spring and the record heat. Not only did we have the highest temperature ever recorded in the month of March of 86 degrees, that was on the 21st, and that was also the warmest we've ever been that early in the season. The whole month of March, the average temperature was the highest it's ever been for a month of March. So there were a lot of those records. We started the month, like 6th, 7th, and 8th, were in the 60s. We got to the 14th through like the 19th, and we were in the upper 70s almost every day, pretty close to 80. And then from the 20th to the 22nd, we were in the mid-80s, pretty much unheard of the month of March. And really what happened across the nation is kind of a backing up of systems. In Europe, they had a really cold winter last winter, as they have this winter. And I don't even remember, right before the Olympics, even in July, they were still getting cold and rainy weather. And that cold air mass sat there. We actually had a nice bubble of high pressure over the eastern half of the nation. What made it even more strange was the fact that it was extremely dry. There was no humidity. When the air is really dry, it can heat up really fast. So most of the eastern half of the nation, the whole month of March, was in a really dry, non-severe, non-stormy pattern, and that allowed the air mass to heat up really nice, and that's why we had all that heat. Of course, that broke down in April, and we had many days that were highs well below normal, below freezing. That whole setup got our orchards growing too fast. We blossomed very quickly. Everything was growing real fast. And, of course, the hard freezes came.
So the phenomenon that really damaged our fruit crop so much was that thaw and freeze.
Yeah, it was setting up all those trees for blossoming early. And, you know, had we had gotten past that 1 week where we had a couple of back-to-back freezes, we would have been off to the races and had probably a really sensational season. But it wiped it out, and I think I read normally apples we ship out something like 98 million tons of apples, and we only put out two, something to that effect. I mean, it was just wiped out all the orchards.
Wow.
Cherry and apples. There were, if you went to any apple orchard this past fall, chances are they had their apples shipped in, so
right,
that there'd be enough for people to enjoy.
So, Andy, where are we sitting now in comparison on this first day of spring? Some snow on the ground, we have some moisture in the ground, and cold temperatures. What's it looking like as we enter the season?
Well, the only thing that resembles spring is the fact that the first day of spring, because we're mentioning the word. Looking at the weather pattern, it's far from it. Our temperatures are running, well, compared to last year, readings are almost 50 degrees colder than it was a year ago, but of course that's too extreme. But the normal high is supposed to be 45 degrees. we may get to 40 this weekend. That'll be the warmest over the next couple of weeks. There's just an extremely cold pool of air for the last month sitting across most of eastern Canada and occasionally coming down our way, and we've been sharing in that, and that's what's happening right now. So there's really no sign of any kind of warm-up. Could there be one day that pops the sun out and we get back to normal? Yeah, but the outlook to the end of this month is from the Rockies eastward, from the Dakotas to Texas and including Florida, all below normal temperatures. If anybody's got spring break next week, I feel sorry for the money they're paying.
Right.
And we're talking about well below normal readings. Will the sun be out next week? Sure, but when you're supposed to be 48 degrees and you can only muster 38, you know, that's well below normal. So that's the pattern here. And to be honest, I don't see it even breaking down in the first week of April. Maybe the very end of the week of that first week, we might finally get to readings that we could call above normal.
Yeah. Andy, can you speak at all to concern there may be about drought as we had last year?
Well, you know, there's the good and the bad with everything, obviously. This recent bout of these 1-inch, 2-inch really wet snows, then they melt away and then they come back. And even what we put on the ground here in the last 24 hours, that has really, really helped out some of the water tables. The farmers are very pleased to see that, as it is in the Central Plains where they've had drought after drought. They love those two big winter storms they had way back in February and all that snow sitting there, because that really helps. If anybody who's driven by their, you know, down their road or through the country and seen the ponds are all drying up, this is going to help that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't help the Great Lakes. That's not how the Great Lakes rise, but it will help the groundwater. It will help the farmers. I'm hoping that we dry out enough so they can get out there and plow them. That might be a problem later in April, is trying to get out there. But certainly that there's a benefit to these on-again, off-again snows. And that's not how we started the winter. We went into the first of the year with 4.5 inches of snow on January 1. That's all we had.
Wow.
And now we're up to almost 30, still about 20 inches below normal, but that's helpful to the water tables and all the farmers, so there's a benefit to that. And, you know, staying cold, anybody who's trying to grow pumpkins or apples or cherries will also tell you, you know, if we can stay colder a little bit longer, that helps them too with insects and bugs, and also helps not having trees blossom too early and get into a normal season. So I don't think any of those people who are, you know, growing all those things care about this cold weather. They will eventually, but not right now.
Andy Provenzano is meteorologist for News 10 WILX Lansing. Andy, thanks very much for the forecast.
Quite welcome. Have a good day.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
In keeping with the theme of spring, we bring you another Current State public poetry announcement.
Morning at Great Pond by Mary Oliver. It starts like this. Forks of light slicking up out of the east, flying over you, and what's left of night, its black waterfalls, its craven doubt, dissolves like gravel as the sun appears, trailing clouds of pink and green wool, igniting the fields, turning the ponds to plates of fire. The creatures there are dark flickerings you make out one by one as the light lifts. Great blue herons, wood ducks shaking their shimmering crests, and knee-deep in the purple shallows a deer drinking. As she turns, the silver water crushes like silk, shaking the sky. And you're healed then from the night. Your heart wants more. You're ready to rise and look, to hurry anywhere, to believe in everything. Morning at Great Pond, Mary Oliver. I'm David Clausen, and this public poetry announcement was brought to you by the Center for Poetry at Michigan State University's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities.
Thanks, David. Coming up Thursday on Current State, we'll discuss the effect of concentrated animal feeding operations on sustainable agriculture. Also, we speak with traditional Irish musician and dancer Nick Garris about sexual minorities in dance. That and lots more Thursday here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering, Yensia Wong, Sam Peters, and Andy Curtis Thanks for your production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Astera Credit Union, a proud supporter of Current State's Neighbors in Action segment. Newest location is now open on West Saginaw Highway on Lansing's west side. Information at asteracu.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.